there's moonbeams in your elbows, and there's rivers in your head. And I wanna see you forever, babe, forever. Don't take me back in time now, but there's nothing for me there.
Welcome to On the Wing Podcast, fueled by Purina Pro Plan. Let's treat this episode as something as a follow-up to Rooster Road Trip 2024. We're going to dive a bit deeper into the North Dakota PLOTS program. And PLOTS stands for Private Land Open to Sportsmen. And we got a fair amount of questions coming out of Rooster Road Trip about PLOTS because our Rooster Road Trip viewers saw how much success we were having on PLOTS, and that elicited a lot of questions. So beginning, PLOTS began in 1997with revenue from North Dakota's hunting license sales, and have been used to pay private landowners for public hunting access on that private land. As we mentioned during the Rooster Road Trip episodes, last year more than 830,000 acres of private land were enrolled in PLOTS for public access. So today, helping me break down PLOTS with a little greater detail, we've got North Dakota State Coordinator back to join us on the Wing Podcast, Emily Spoliar, and our featured guest is North Dakota Game, Fish, and Parks Private Land Section Leader, Kevin Kading. I screwed up the title already, didn't I, Kevin? Because in North Dakota, Parks isn't part of the department like it is in some states.
No, you're right. It's North Dakota Game and Fish Department. Yep, not Parks or not a DNR, but close enough.
Every state's got their own little wrinkle there. Emily, you've been on the podcast a bunch, but for listeners kind of just jumping in for the first time, go ahead and introduce yourself and take us away.
Yeah, thanks, Bob. I'm happy to join you once again for another podcast episode. Lost track of how many we've done at this point together, but they're always fun. So thanks for having us, and thanks for taking the time to highlight North Dakota and the great work we have going on here for another episode. But yeah, I'm the state coordinator, so I get to support all of our field staff in the state, and then work with our partners to develop and maintain strong partnerships. And then I help manage all of our grant sources. So whether that's for positions or programs, I get to do all of that fun office work with grant management. So that's a little bit about my position. But as I mentioned, part of that is working closely with partners, and Kevin and the entire North Dakota Game and Fish Department is, one of several fantastic partners we have in the state. They help us keep our boots on the ground. And, Kevin is a big part of that. So, Kevin, thank you for joining us today.
Absolutely. It's great to be here with you guys.
So tell us a little bit about your background. Are you a native North Dakotan? Does your pursuits take you out bird hunting? Give us a little bit of the Kevin Kading story.
The short answer is yes and yes, but I'm a native North Dakota kid. I grew up in the southeastern part of the state, so pretty close to Minnesota. If anybody's familiar with the Cheyenne National Grasslands, that corner of the state, kind of down in that area, down by Kindred, Colfax, down in that country. So that's the Red River Valley. You know, that's kind of that primo egg cropland area of the state, and so not a lot of habitat in that part of the state, unfortunately. But back when I grew up over there, we had some wetlands on the landscape and some more CRP on the landscape, and so it's changed a lot since I've left that area of the state, unfortunately. But my journey was primarily with North Dakota Game and Fish. Honestly, I spent a lot of the time with my career right here. Worked in our field office in Jamestown, North Dakota as a wildlife technician over there. Did the summer thing for a few years, like a lot of kids do coming right out of school, and and worked my way up, waited around for some full-time opportunities to come along, did some technician work, which was, looking back, was probably one of my more enjoyable jobs. You know, we were out there putting up fence and mowing grass, parking lots and planting grass, and just, you know, kind of free to do what you need to. And as long as you get the work done, you know, and not a lot of big responsibilities, you know, like that came along with that, just get it done and come home safe. But it was a great experience. And then I worked over here in Bismarck, which is where I am now. I'm in our main office here in Bismarck. Started out doing GIS work, actually. And then transitioned into private lands, was a private lands biologist for several years, and then jumped into the section leader role here as private lands section leader, which oversees our program. So that's kind of where my path took me. And as far as, bird hunter, I grew up duck hunting, really. I mean, that was my my thing growing up. And not that we didn't hunt pheasants, but like I said, we just didn't have a lot of that. CRP was just coming on the landscape at the time. And so we grew up hunting a lot of WPAs for waterfowl. And so that also probably explains why I have a big brown Chesapeake at home. that was my parents. We had labs too, but we've always had flushers for the most part. And we had a Chesapeake. My dad's friend had a Chesapeake, and I guess got attached to him. You kind of have to have a fondness for him. They're a different animal, but they're pretty cool dogs. So still have one today.
So I've got about 300 episodes of our podcast underneath us, and I think you're our first Chesapeake
owner. Oh, yeah.
So we're going to take this opportunity for you to boast about the Chesapeake. What do you love about Chesapeakes? What's their strengths and weaknesses? And what's your pup's name?
Well, the strengths and weaknesses, I would say, are, you know, like any dog, honestly. And they're all different individuals, too. My first Chesapeake was, he was the, read all the textbook, you know, the real hard-headed, tough, kind of a one-person dog. And that was fine when I was a single guy. And this one I have now, I call him a mama's boy. He's kind of a spoiled baby, big sweetheart, you know, but he's a good dog. I just like the versatility of him. You know, they can do anything, you know. I mean, they're not afraid of the cold water, the snow, he's a big square dog, so we can push through those heavy cover in the fall, you know, and late season roosters, and he does it all. But yeah, I mean, I just, you know, everybody's got their thing. Everybody's got their dog. And I've just really, they're super intelligent, which I'm sure everybody says about their dog. But I've always kind of liked how they just hunt for themselves and they kind of figure it out, you know, a couple hand signals and away he goes, and work really well together. So that's what I like about him. My first one was named appropriately. His name was Grizz because he was built like a grizzly bear. And this one is Deuce because he's offspring of the same parents. So he's number two. So that's how we ended up with that. That, you know, having Chesties in our life has always been a big thing. So
how is their endurance? I mean, I think about Chesties and their, I mean, how much does Deuce weigh?
He's a big 100-pound dog, yeah.
100-pound. Can they go all day, or do you have to be deliberate about taking breaks?
Yeah, well, we both can't really go all day anymore. So the trouble with them is they want to go all day, you know, so I got to be careful. We don't do a lot of the, you know, like big sharp-tailed grouse early season, September stuff is tough on them when it's hot out. So we hunt a lot of, like I said, we do a lot of duck hunting early season. We're spending time on the water and things like that. But no, I mean, it just like any dog, I guess you got to take it easy with them. But you know, it's so different than, pointers and dogs that just take off and go over the hill. I don't even know what to do when that happens. I'm like, call your dog. It's running away. I don't really know how to react because I'm used to being within 30 feet of my dog all the time. Sure. You know, and so, but yeah, it's, they do well, but probably not, you know, he's a big one too, so they're a little tougher on their bones and their structure, I think, if you take it too hard on them. But we spend a lot of time just sitting along the wetland and waiting for birds to come to us.
So. Yeah, sounds like a perfect fit based on your love of duck hunting and throw in some cattail chasing roosters in there, and it's a great fit for you.
Yeah, it works out well, yep.
Well, we're going to dive into kind of the history and the background on plots. Before we do, I'd like to recognize Purina Pro Plan, as the national dog food sponsor of Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever's wildlife habitat mission, and the presenting sponsor of On the Wing podcast. All three of my pups, Esky, Gitchy, and Winter, all eat Purina Pro Plan, not just because of Purina's support of our wildlife habitat mission, but because they have the world's best scientists and nutritionists behind their dog food. You can learn more at ProPlanSport.com, Purina Pro Plan, nutrition that performs. All right, in the intro, I talked about plots being created way back in 1997. Sounds like a long time ago, but in the grand scheme of things, it's not all that long ago. Kevin, were you around, Kevin, when it was created, when plots was created in the legislature?
I was just coming into the game about that time. Yep.
Oh, great! Yeah. So, do you have a recollection about kind of the context for it being introduced?
I sure do, and it actually goes back probably about 10 years before that, you know, because 1985, if a lot of your listeners know, that was the introduction to the Conservation Reserve Program. And so in those late 80s and early 90s, a lot of that CRP was hitting the ground here in North Dakota. Mm-hmm. And in response, great pheasant hunting and wildlife populations responded very well. And a lot of hunting increased because of that. Along with that came some of the not so good stuff, you know, maybe the increased posting or less access to some of those areas, or some fee hunting. And, you know, for the average person, it was getting a little bit more difficult than what they were used to in the past. And people wanted access to those birds. And the legislature and the hunters basically looked to the Game and Fish Department to try to find a solution for that. And so that was in that, right around that era, you know. And then prior to the plots program, though, the Game and Fish always had a private lands program, but it wasn't as robust. It was mostly just wildlife food plots and some habitat plantings, and there was really no big public access component tied to it. Just because there wasn't the issues back then, I guess, you know, access wasn't as difficult to come by. And so when you tie all those things together, that's kind of what, you know, what was the reason for the legislature looking to us to develop the plots program. And in those early years, probably the first 5 years or so, it was really just tied to the southwestern part of the state where we have our good traditional pheasant area. And targeting CRP, new CRP that was being put in. And it was a good match. You know, it worked really well. Landowners were looking for extra cost share assistance to put that into CRP. And we came along with that program that helped cover their costs of seeding. And then it just kind of grew from there. But the original intent was pheasant hunting access and upland game hunting access, but it just kind of kept growing, you know, the popularity of it. It was well received by landowners, by hunters. Obviously they liked going out there and having these places, and our legislature, you know, just funding, we kept, you know, receiving additional funds, because the need kept growing and people wanted it, not just in the Southwest, they wanted it in other parts of the state. And so then we kind of ended up covering, I guess, almost like 2/3 or 3/4 of the state, you know, with where our traditional pheasant area is at, in the southeast all the way up to the northwest. And the northeastern part of our state still really had kind of a hole. We didn't really have a lot of pheasants up there at the time. But people were looking at it for deer hunting access or waterfowl hunting access. And it just kind of, over the years, just kind of kept growing. So it's changed a lot from what the original intent was back then, but in a positive way, I would say. You know, it's become more than just CRP and more than just pheasant access. It's all species and all types of habitat.
Well, do you remember, you talked about how it's grown and evolved, like that first year or two. Was it right out of the gates super successful, or did it take time to build?
It was successful, but it was just small, you know, like I said, it was just, you know, there's only
geographically located in one area, and then then it kind of burgeoned from there.
Well, and then we were only taking or targeting CRP. So you take a small area and you had to have CRP and it had to be new CRP. And and so, yeah, it was, you know, 20, 30,000 acres for the first year or two. Then it kind of went up to 40, 50, you know, it just kind of slowly, incrementally came up. But that's when CRP was really doing well in North Dakota too. So we had big acreages when we had signups, you know, we would have 200,000 acres or 300,000 acres at a time or more. And so it didn't take long to really expand it and grow. And then it really started to kind of grow quicker.
What was the all time high watermark for plots in the state? How many acres?
About 1.1 ish million in 2007.
Okay. So it dovetailed perfectly even at that time with when CRP was at a high water mark in 2006, 2007.
It does really well. It does match up really well. You've probably seen some of these charts that we've displayed where it just shows CRP, pheasant harvest, CRP, or plots acres. It all kind of goes the same. They mirror each other just almost to a T. And that's why, I mean, because they're all related. So,
From a landowner's perspective, talk to us a little bit about the value proposition for plots, because in order for it to succeed, it's got to succeed for a landowner.
Right. It's all over the board. You know, really some people want it just because they've always liked allowing hunting access, you know, and other people want to see a little income, a little extra income off the property. It kind of varies across the board on what people, how they value it. But it really does have to work for them. And so it's a fairly flexible program in ways that, what I mean by that is there's different types of plots agreements, you know, that a landowner can choose to go with something that's short term, or they can choose to go with something a little longer term. They can go into something that allows them a little bit more use versus maybe something that pays a little more. But we have a little bit more of the management or control over it, you know, that type of thing. So really kind of everybody values it a little bit differently, but we've got a lot of good landowners in the program. And I think a lot of it, if you boil it down to, is they really believe in continuing that hunting heritage in our state and really value. We get people that, you know, tell us that hunters came up to them and knocked on a door and thanked them for putting their land in the program. And they've made, you know, lifelong friendships over things like that. So it's pretty neat to hear those stories.
Yeah. When a landowner declines, says, I'm a little nervous about this, what's the reason for the trepidation? What's the number one reason that they'd say no to plots?
Again, it kind of depends what they're doing. If they were, you know, if they were just allowing access, they're not looking to do any habitat improvements, or they just have what they have and they just want to put it into the program. And then we get to a point where they say, nah, not interested. It's usually because they're afraid it's going to become too much use on it. On the other end of the spectrum, if they were, maybe they had cropland and they wanted to plant that back to grass or put it into some habitat program, that one usually comes down to dollars and cents. You know, is it, does it pay enough? Is it worth, can I make more money renting it or farming it or some other use on it? But it really comes down to probably those two things. Or, you know, sometimes there's family decisions that have to be made, you know, that's things like that. But usually it's, yeah, and that's one of the things that we always tell people as well. Then start with a 1-year agreement or start with a 2-year agreement. See how you like it. Put, you know, dip your toes in the water, and you'll find out it probably isn't that bad, or it does work out for you. And we've had a lot of people that do that, and then they've been in our program for 15 years now. You know, just because they say, "Oh, put me in for 2 years," and then they like it, and 2 years later they sign it up for another 2 years, and here we go. So.
Kevin, do you want to touch a little bit on how the payment rates vary between types of land? Because I think that's a question that I know I run into a lot, is people thinking that Game and Fish is paying the same amount for an acre of cropland versus a cattail slough or existing grass habitat. Do you want to talk about how you guys have structured the program to try to find that balance of access but also quality access?
Yeah, I can talk about that, and I'll, you know, be pretty general when I answer that, just because it gets into the weeds, and I don't want to put numbers out there that, you know, someone will hold us to. But but really, it's, you know, it depends on the type of land use that's out there, the habitat base that's out there. Like I said, some lands are strictly just access only, and they may be, that land might have cropland, it might have hayland, it might have actively grazed pasture, you know, that type of thing. And those generally are paying less than, you know, maybe at $1 to $5, $6, somewhere in that range. If you were to just kind of average that out for like cropland, there's not a lot of value there for hunting, but we recognize that you can get access to it, and there might be some wetlands in the middle of that field or a drainage that goes through it. But primarily the wetland or that drainage, that's where their higher payment is going to come from. And on the other end of the spectrum, like I mentioned earlier, if somebody plants grass, you know, if they take cropland and put it into grass, they're going to get a rental payment that's going to be similar to the average county rent. So just no different than if you rented it to the neighbor for farming. And so those are much higher. So we always say, you know, payments can range from $1 an acre to $150 an acre. It really depends on what you have out there. But, and we do hear questions. I was going to say criticism, but I think a lot of it's just confusion. People don't understand that a quarter section of a plots tract that might have, you know, 120 acres of cropland on it, that cropland is only receiving a small amount of money, maybe $1 an acre. But the bigger dollars coming from the wetlands or that drainage that might be out there, or that native prairie hillside, or the huntable habitat cover, which is going to be much higher. And that's where the, you know, the landlord's bulk of their payment is coming from. And so, we do get a lot of questions on that. Like, why would you enroll cropland? Why would you enroll pasture? Well, for one thing, it's fairly on the low end of, on the payment side, but it's also, a good opportunity too. Sometimes we enroll cropland for waterfall hunting, field hunting access. And other times it's cropland that is in a few years, it's going to be seeded to grass. You know, it's in that transition. And so it's really kind of varies out there. You know, it's a hard one to answer when somebody asks, why do you do that? Well, we almost have to look up that particular agreement and say, well, here's what's going on. But I don't know if that helped answer that, Emily. I mean, it's kind of a, it depends type answer.
Yeah. And I think for me, just in my previous position as a precision ag and conservation specialist, you know, I got a little peek behind the curtains working with your private lands biologist staff and seeing the amount of thought and planning that goes into each of these signups. And it was super insightful, just having a better understanding of the time and effort that gets put into each of these agreements. And so I think, like you said, it's a lot of times just people not knowing that much thought is put into it, and that you're not necessarily taking every acre that's offered. You know, you're very thoughtful and intentional about making sure it's the right type of acreage in depending on that location, and, you know, your priority focus areas within that location. And yeah, there's a lot of time and effort and care that goes into making those decisions and building and maintaining those relationships with landowners.
We always say that it's a habitat-based hunting access program. And so there's a reason we enrolled that quarter section or that piece, because there's some hunting value there. And it might not be for, you know, if you're looking to come up to a field that's, you know, up to your eyeballs and in big blue stem for pheasants, well, that might not be what that particular plots tract is all about. That one might be down the road, but the one that you're looking at here might be a cropland field that's enrolled for waterfall hunting access, or, you know, the payments are going to be widely ranging between those two. So, yeah, I think it's a common question, but I think a lot of people are starting to understand that now. When we jumped from, like I mentioned, back in those early years of enrolling only CRP into other land use types, we got some scrutiny over that, because people would say, why is that piece of pasture enrolled? Why is it being grazed? You know, why is it, why is there cropland? And then that, that question has quieted down quite a bit because people are recognizing that, you know what, that crop field, that quarter out there, there's a little wetland in the middle of it. That's a great little rooster honey hole every fall. And a lot of people drive by it, but I'm happy to walk out there and find that little honey hole. And so I think people are recognizing that now. So
does landlocked public lands ever come into the plot's decision-making matrix? In other words, is there a piece of, like a WMA or a WPA that just is hard to get to, but if this landowner opened up their property to plots, it may not be terrific habitat on this plot's land, but it, you know, the world's your oyster and you can walk through that and get to something that's landlocked. Is that part of the decision-making complex?
It certainly factors into it, even with adjacent plots. You know, if there's a nice piece of CRP that we can't get to, but there's a quarter of cropland or hayland that gets us access to that, we can enroll both quarters just to make sure we have access to the better stuff. And it has worked that way. Yeah. Sometimes like with our high water levels in the eastern part of the state, there's a lot of areas that are just not accessible. But if you have a plots track that gets you from here to here, you can now access it, like a WPA or wildlife management area. There's not a lot of that, but it does come up sometimes.
So the other thing that I've always wondered, you have a very unique trespass law in North Dakota, and I'd like you to tell our listeners about that. But then the part B of the question is, if somebody doesn't mark their land as posted, why wouldn't they just naturally apply for plots? Can you explain first the unique laws in North Dakota?
Yeah. Most states, land is posted closed unless otherwise, you know, unless you ask for permission. In North Dakota, it's open unless otherwise posted closed. And so you can go out, and that's for hunting, though, not for just anything. You can't go out there and camp or, you know, do other things. That's for hunting. But so you can go out, and if there's no sign on it that says posted closed, or if it's not electronically signed posted, then you can access that land. And so that is unique. A lot of people that come here from other states don't, you know, almost can't believe that. But
yeah, it's hard to trust. It's like,
I was scared.
Yeah, and I also feel somewhat compelled to, like, gosh, I got to ask somebody and make sure this is okay. And well, I'm assuming they like that, or maybe they don't. Maybe they just, they don't want to be bothered.
I think it really is depends on that individual. I've done that. I've actually went and knocked on a door, even on unposted land, and they said, why are you asking? Have at it. And then there's other times they just really appreciate it. And I know one thing, I always feel better getting that permission and just knowing that I'm okay.
Yeah.
Just the way the world is now, and it does feel good. And you sometimes start a bigger discussion and a relationship over that type of thing. But it is a law. You can do that. And the only thing that has changed here is that electronic component to that. And now it's also able to be posted electronically, not just with a paper sign. And so that's a little bit unique as well in North Dakota. And it's new. And I don't know where that'll go, you know, but I think it's here to stay. You know, I mean, there's been some discussion about doing away with the actual physical posted, you know, like the paper sign, and just keeping it all electronic, one or the other. I think there's a lot of different opinions on that. But yeah, that's what North Dakota's law is. And your second question, as far as why wouldn't people just, you know, if they're not posting it closed, I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. It's kind of, we've also had the same thing where people have been in our plots program for many years and then they choose not to re-enroll, but then they don't post their land. And it's like, well, I don't understand that. You were getting a payment before and now you're still having people hunt it, but you're not getting paid. So it's to each their own, I guess. And I think a lot of it is probably more and more these days. I think there's a lot of family members involved in some of these decisions, and takes a while to kind of wrangle everybody up and get everybody on the same page, and it's probably not as black and white as we think.
Yeah. As you think about the plots program and your internal your decision-making process, I'm assuming you've got some goals on a year-to-year basis. How do those get formulated? Is that something that Is the legislature involved? Is it internal at this point? How does the path forward get created?
Back in that 2007 era, when we hit that 1 million acres, that was actually a goal set by our governor at that time. It was Governor Hoven at the time. And he set a goal of 1 million acres by 2009. And that really wasn't anything more than a number, I think. I don't think there's really any basis for it. It was just a nice number to shoot for. And we've kind of held on to that, though, as far as like how we would want to get back to 1 million acres. But we also said that we don't want to just enroll 1 million acres if they're just not very good. We'd rather have fewer acres, but better acres, you know, instead of just saying, yep, we hit our goal. You know, look at that, everybody, we got 1 million acres, you know, and because we could do that. We could do that pretty quick. You know, we could go out and probably sign up 1.5 million acres, but it wouldn't be the stuff that people want, and they wouldn't be very, very happy with us. So we're kind of strategic, like Emily said, we're trying to be, you know, strategic about how we do it. And then I wouldn't say the legislature's involved, but this, you know, as far as setting a goal, but they certainly are when it comes to our funding. And so some of the goals and some of what we do on the landscape depends on how much funding we have. And so we recently just kind of dusted off that 1 million acre goal again, and also added, you know, 40,000 acres of access every year to hit that 1 million acres by 2028. And then within that, there's kind of a step down goal for us to try to get 6,000 acres of that to be new habitat every year. So, and those are in response to things that we're hearing from the public, you know, just the pressure to get more access, but also good access. And so we're stepping up that goal again to try to really hit that again. And so those are the reasons we also have right now, actually, just our legislative session just started and just kicked off, and we're requesting some more spending authority. It's going to take more money to get to those goals. And as much as I'd like to say they're strategic, like based on, you know, the state, you know, they are, I mean, but they're not necessarily like, there's not a big, you know, model or science behind it a whole lot. It's more like, where do we think we need the access? What are the landowners? What are we reading from the temperature out there? And where are the areas that we really seem like, you know, we need that to increase opportunities for access. And so we look at some of that harvest information, you know, whether it's for deer or pheasants or some of that stuff. Where are the, you know, some of our surveys that tell us where people are hunting the most. We've also asked some new questions on our surveys, like, where do you want plots? You know, I know where you hunt the most, but where do you think you would want to hunt more? And so we're strategic that way, but it still becomes a little bit of a kind of an opportunity, you know, like wherever we have an opportunity, we're still willing to work with the landowner. You don't have to be in a defined area, say, we're not looking at that area. That's not in our goals for this year. We would still be able to work with people. But
Kevin, do you want to talk about some of the work that private lands biologists do to help create those opportunities and, you know, just the amount of effort? I think people a lot of times forget that there are people behind these programs and people who genuinely care about the success of the program. So maybe take a minute to talk about the private lands biologist on your staff and just kind of some of the heart and soul that they put into this program. Because I know from experience how hard they work and that they're in difficult positions trying to balance everything and walk that tightrope of happy hunters and happy landowners and happy farmers. And so maybe take a minute and talk about that.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess behind the scenes where the work gets done is we've got 10 private lands biologists out on the landscape, and you know, they've each got a handful of counties, 4, 5, 6 counties each, and so they cover a big area, a lot of square miles, a lot of windshield time. A lot of working with different partners, a lot of working with USDA offices and landowners. And so they do a lot of outreach, a lot of promotion, and we do a lot of that here as well. I don't remember what it was, but, I mean, we send out, you know, 30,000 postcards is nothing. You know, we'll send, you know, old school things like that, postcards. Mm-hmm. We'll do a lot of digital marketing and digital advertising and social media and landowner workshops. And so there's a lot that goes into getting it to that point. You know, we don't just wait for someone to walk in the door and voila, you know, they've got a plots agreement and the signs are up and people are hunting. It's a lot that goes into it. And then you throw in, like I said, the difference now with, you've got renters involved, you got landowners with trusts or multiple family members and people out of state. I mean, we've sent agreements overseas to Iraq to soldiers that are serving to get signed. You know, I mean, it's not like people think. You just don't sign up a piece of land and away you go. There's a lot of work. And then they have to maintain those acres, you know. So these aren't, these agreements range from a couple years to maybe 10 years. And so at some point, the renewal expires, or the agreement expires, and has to be re-upped. And so our field staff are working on those. So, I mean, just to maintain the acres in the program is a huge lift, let alone seek out and pursue new acres. And so, yeah, it does take a lot behind the scenes. We wouldn't have a program without, A, without the landowners, but also, B, without the field staff, the private lands biologists out there that are out there with the boots on the ground every day and talking to these landowners. And some of them need a lot of help guiding them through things. Other ones are relatively easy, and it's everything in between. But, yeah, they put a lot of time in, a lot of miles, and it seems like they barely get done with one batch of agreements, and we're rinse and repeat, and we're back to doing it all over again. So,
well, that was my next question, is about timing. You know, as we record here in early 2025, is now the start of a new cycle, or is it really dependent upon, like you mentioned, like 1 year agreements, 10 year agreements? It's ongoing.
It's ongoing, but it really, I mean, right now what our staff are working on is, for the most part, they're working on anything that expired in December of 2023, and to re-up those acres. At the same time, we're promoting and marketing and trying to get new interests, so they've got that stack of interest. And then, like I said, maintaining those other ones that are existing out there. So it's a combination, but really right now is more that renewal stage. And then they jump into the taking on the new acres. And it's just kind of an all never ending, really, because you have some, like I said, that, you know, once you get them signed up for 10 years, you're good. But then other ones are 2 years. So you're visiting some more frequently than others. And it just kind of is a never-ending pattern. But we have a schedule set up for all that every year, and so staff have an idea what's coming.
So just for clarity, you mentioned the end of 23.
I meant 24.
Is it because of – okay. Yeah. I didn't know if it was like 2 year cycles or just – okay, the end of 2024, so kick off 2025 with brand new agreements.
Right, yeah. We're starting to get them worked up so they can start them in, you know, people that want to plant grass or do some do some habitat work this spring. That all has to start now, or even before now, you know, get going on that stuff soon, because landowners are making plans and they need to know what's going on. And so it's pretty well nonstop. The only thing that we kind of do is for a shutdown period, if you want to call it that, is when we kind of button things up about mid-July, just for the sake of getting a plots guide and our signs up and getting things buttoned up for the fall hunting season.
You've talked about, you know, when plots was created, it was largely a pheasant-oriented program, and as things have evolved, people utilize it for waterfowl hunting and deer hunting. Do you have a sense of what the percentage breakdown is on pursuits, you know, like, you know, X number of percent of folks chase Sharpies using plots, and, you know, what, like, can you give a quick picture of what that looks like?
You know, it's probably about an even, you know, third, deer, pheasants, waterfowl. It really is. I mean, it gets tough on our surveys because I think a lot of North Dakota hunters, probably a lot of folks are this way, but we're kind of generalists. You know, I'll hunt a plots tract for deer, ducks, and pheasants. You know, I mean, it's, and how do I answer that in a survey? You know, I hunted all those at the same, you know, in the same area, but those are kind of the big three that drive it, and they're pretty well evenly split out.
Cool. I'm going to transition us to kind of looking towards the future, and I want to talk about the really innovative idea, the Habitat and Access Summit you guys recently held. Before we jump into that, I want to give a shout out to Onyx, proud supporter of the podcast and Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever's wildlife habitat mission. If you are not yet an Onyx subscriber, you've been living in a rock for the last decade, you can go to Onyx Hunt's website. There's a link to it in the show notes. And use the code PFQF and you get 20% off your Onyx membership. And Onyx Hunt will make a donation back to Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever's wildlife habitat mission. All right, so really innovative idea that an event that occurred, I think it was December of 24, called the Habitat and Access Summit. Kevin, tell us about that event and kind of what the goal was.
Yeah, we just did this about a month ago now, December 17th here in Bismarck, and it was the Habitat and Hunting Access Summit. And what we were doing there is we just wanted to bring in the public and raise that level of awareness. We've been hearing more about habitat concerns. Whether you didn't draw a deer tag, whether you didn't have a successful hunt, you know, whatever it might be, but we wanted to bring that level of awareness up about what's going on out there, put some data to it as well, show people what we have for information, and then try to figure out some action items on what we can do moving forward, and not just us, you know, as a Game and Fish Department, but what hunters can do, what landowners can do, what do we want, what do North Dakotans want the state to look like in 10 years from now as far as our future hunting heritage, and really kind of open that dialogue, I guess, with that. And so a lot of it was mostly just getting information out and the awareness about what's going on, and then letting the public know what we are working on. There's a lot of habitat loss, you know, right now, but there's also some really good partner programs and partnerships going on, and some success stories that we wanted to also let people know about too. So that was kind of the goal, and we had a really good turnout. We had about a little over 200 people. And prior to when people registered, we let them submit a question or a comment or something they wanted addressed, and that worked out really well because we were able to kind of tailor our presentations and our information around that. So we felt like we were addressing their questions or comments in some way, at least, you know, maybe not directly answering somebody's question, but we had it integrated into our presentations. And then at the end, we had some follow-up, follow-up feedback, and we received really good information from people and some new stuff, you know, some new things that people are saying and wanting and thinking about, and some stuff that we already, ideas and things that we probably already knew or that aren't really off the wall. But overall, it was good, and it feels like there's some momentum going there. Some of those recommendations we'll be sharing with, and in fact, I already shared them with some of our partners already, but we want to build off of those. We want to get some collaboration going and find out ways that we can work together with different groups, with landowner groups, ag groups, energy, conservation. We're all in it together. So how do we secure our future hunting heritage in the state? And so it's a really good kickoff point.
You guys did a phenomenal job with that event, and I thought the attendance was awesome, seeing that many people show up, you know, on a December evening to take part in the discussion amongst each other and listen to all the presentations. I know for me, one of the highlights of that event was listening to our new governor speak about the importance of habitat and how much he cares about our hunting heritage in North Dakota. That was awesome to hear that from our governor. Knowing that, you know, we're all moving forward with similar goals in mind of more habitat that equals more wildlife and more hunting opportunities. Was there a highlight for you during that event, Kevin? I know you guys put a lot of time and effort into it. And just if there were a couple high points that you enjoyed from that event.
I would joke if I didn't say the meatballs were pretty good. Yeah, we had a joke about that because we were trying to get a head count and how many people were going to be there and how many meatballs. And there's a lot of work that went into this thing, but I don't think I've ever planned anything about, you know, that much about meatballs and pounds of meat and all that stuff. But no, it was a great event overall. I mean, the highlight for me, Emily, was just the great turnout. Like you said, the governor came in, and I'll be honest, I guess I didn't really know what to expect. You know, we got a brand new governor. We've got this whole crowd of people in the room, and he came in and nailed it, you know, talked about the importance of our heritage and access and what hunting means to people and families and why people want to come to North Dakota or stay in North Dakota. And it was like, wow, that really set the tone for the rest of the meeting. So that made it, just took a load off of my shoulders, I think, you know, is kind of how I would put it. It just felt like that just set the stage for the rest of the discussion. And then just, you know, obviously we did some presentations and we had a couple panel discussions with landowners and legislators and, you know, different people on those panels, and that went well. People had, you know, heard some things from other than just the North Dakota Game and Fish. And then afterwards it was just good conversation. It felt like even if you didn't maybe agree with something, you still understood that we're all, you know, looking for the same thing here. You know, we want to all continue to hunt. We want to have good habitat. We might not see eye to eye on everything, but boy, we sure all like to get out in the fall and enjoy what we have here. And so that was kind of the highlight for me.
Well, kudos to you guys for having an event and opening a dialogue. It's very easy, you know, to just, we've done it this way every year for the last 100 years. We're going to keep doing it that way. But no, you opened up the conversation and invited a well-rounded discussion. That's terrific. Are there plans to keep doing this? Is this a annual thing, or was it, well, we don't know. We just kind of got it started here.
Yeah, it was, we don't really know, I guess, as far as another summit per se, but we certainly don't want it to just end here. You know, this, like I said, we've got 3 pages of recommendations that are probably going to continue to grow, I think. You know, that was just kind of what we took all that feedback and comments and boiled it down into 4 main categories, and that would be habitat, access, obviously those two, but hunter landowner relations, and then funding and policy. And so, you know, you could almost say every one of those kind of overlaps with each other. Mm-hmm. I mean, they really do. Habitat and access overlap, funding and policy overlap with habitat and access. And so there's a lot of kind of a little bit of redundancy in there, but there's some really good recommendations that we want to get together and move forward. And we've got some good information now. This didn't come from solely the North Dakota Game and Fish Department. This was the people that want to have hunting and habitat, and they were the ones that were providing these recommendations. So it'll help provide that extra kickstart in the discussions, I think. So, I don't know if we'll have another summit here, but, you know, maybe down the road, maybe not, you know, right away, but maybe down the road there'd be something like that as a follow-up or something, but I'm not sure.
When you think about our audience, Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever audience, and, you know, we're talking to Quail Forever members and, you know, South Georgia to, you know, folks that hunt mountain quail in Oregon to, you know, traveling pheasant hunters from Michigan and Wisconsin. North Dakota is one of those destination states that people circle on their calendars. You know, those, the 7 days where they buy their license and live in North Dakota for a week, and it's the highlight of the year. But how those non-residents portray themselves or lead themselves as hunters, traveling hunters in your state, is there anything that you want the non-resident hunters to think about as they plan their trip to your state next year? Things that we could do better, or things that you just want them to know to have a better hunt?
Boy, that's tricky, Bob. I don't know. I don't want to get in trouble here, but
it wouldn't be the first time I've been called a blue plater. So you're in the trust tree.
Yeah, and I almost don't even want to paint them with the same brush. I mean, residents and non-residents, it doesn't matter where you're from. I feel like you need to be responsible regardless, you know, and understanding of landowners. And but yeah, maybe with as far as being a non-resident out-of-stater, like anything, get to know the rules, you know, understand our laws, understand our different things that are going on in our landscape. You know, whether it's a section line law or whether it's a posted laws or things like that. I mean, that would certainly keep you out of trouble, but also it makes landowners feel a little bit better knowing who's out there like that, you know, that they're people that are following the laws and doing it the right way. But, and there's a lot to try to understand when you're coming to a new state, but I'd say get familiar with that. And then just kind of understand too, that, you know, maybe they're coming from a different part of the world and things work differently here than they do in your wherever you're coming from, and be respectful of that. Landowners maybe have a reason why they do or don't allow hunting access, or they only allow it for certain people or certain times, things like that. I think just be appreciative. I know it's frustrating when you knock on a lot of doors and try to get permission, or and you don't get permission, that type of thing. But, you know, that's part of the reason why plots are available too. You know, that's, you don't have to do all that. But when it comes to plots, boy, I mean, it really is important, again, whether you're a resident hunter or non-resident hunter, just leave them in a better situation than when you came here. And one little thing can really set somebody off. You know, if a gate's left open that shouldn't be, or there's a pile of dead pheasants by the gate, or I don't even as far as just parking in the wrong spot, sometimes those little things make a difference. And so try to understand what's going on. It's a busy time of the year for producers, you know, and you got a combine coming down the road. Make sure you're aware of that. Just, you know, be aware of that. You're kind of out in their world now, you know? And so,
yeah.
Be respectful about everything that's going on across the countryside.
Yeah, I think those are great points. I mean, ultimately, it does boil down to be respectful. Mm-hmm. Respectful of the landowner and respectful of the land. Mm-hmm. You know, I just, you know, seeing garbage and guts and dead, you know, it just, we can all take that on our own to be better about that, no matter what state you're traveling to or you're in. Go ahead, Emily.
Yeah, I was just going to add, I always encourage people to just take a minute to think about all the pieces of the puzzle that had to come together to provide an abundance of wildlife on a piece of property you might be hunting. It happens because of very intentional effort, whether that's from the landowner or partner organizations. It's not there by accident. I mean, you know, a lot of time and effort and thoughtful planning gets put into maintaining high quality habitat. I was fortunate to take one of my out of state girlfriends hunting in North Dakota this year, and I took her on a piece of private ground that's not enrolled in the plots program that I've gotten to work very closely with the landowner to help develop some habitat projects. And we were maybe half an hour into the hunt, and I walked up to her and she had just shot a rooster and she was crying. And we had seen so many birds. She's from Pennsylvania. And she said, I didn't even know that it was possible for something to look like this. I didn't know it was possible to have this many birds. She just didn't realize, you know, what potential was even out on the landscape for having an impact on wildlife populations. And so that was just really special to take a minute, you know, as we're watching roosters just boiling out of this grass planting, just being able to take a minute and really appreciate, oh yeah, we were very fortunate to have the resources that we have here. And it is really special to be able to share it. And I think it's also our job to remind people that it doesn't happen without landowners who care and without good quality habitat programs and without, you know, us doing our part to encourage keeping good quality habitat on the ground and trying to get ahead of things and get some new acres back where we can.
Yeah, right on. It's perfectly teed up to how I want to end this episode with your favorite memory on plot. So you get to roll out two of them here in a moment, Emily. As folks think about hunting season 2025, you talked about that July time frame where you kind of have the end of the sign-up period. When will folks be able to look at Onyx and start planning out and see if, oh, my favorite spot is back re-enrolled? When's that window of time where people can start doing those e-scouting?
That's about efforts? That time frame, somewhere in that July to August time frame, start looking for that, and that's when things get updated. There's always some last-minute stuff that changes a little bit, but yeah, for the most part. And we are, one thing I didn't mention earlier is we're looking at more of a continual sign up so we can kind of keep going past that July, just because we don't print as many paper materials anymore. Mm-hmm. I would say in a few years, we probably won't even print that plots guide anymore. Because I don't know, you probably don't even have one in your vehicle anymore. Most people, that used to be the thing. When a print plots guide was printed, you'd run to the license vendor or come to the Game and Fish and get your printed copy. But now it's instant, it's on Onyx, and so there's really no need. And so we don't really need that to stop the assembly line, just to stop and print that thing and get it delivered. And so that's an advantage to having some technology for sure. So, and that means we can keep signing more land up too, and a little bit later into the year. So at some point though, we still kind of have to flip the switch from, okay, this is going to be enrolled for this year, but then we get to a certain point, well, now we're already in the hunting season. We got to stop and enroll that person for next year. And so it kind of varies on that, but yeah, I mean, it's pretty quick nowadays versus how it used to be.
Yeah. All right. So as we close, I do want you to think about your favorite memory that ever occurred on a piece of plots ground. If there's anything that, tugs at your heartstrings, like the story Emily just shared. And then also, as we wind up, anything that we missed that you wanted to talk about during this conversation. We'll start with Kevin. Any memory that comes to mind and anything we missed?
About 20 years worth of memories, I guess, if you were to put it that way. It's hard because I got three kids and they've all had some experience out on a plots tract, whether it's a mourning dove or a first deer. But, you know, if I were to kind of boil it down, I'd say it's not even a particular memory on like a hunt. It's a particular plots tract that it's been in for 20 some years now. And we've gotten to know the landowner very well. All of my kids, my wife, my family has hunted on it. It's just a special place, you know, one of those places. And it was one of my dad's favorite places to deer hunt, and he's passed on now. And so just one of those where you go, man, that's become a piece of my hunting life, you know, and thanks to that landowner, I can't even explain to him how many memories he's made, you know, and that's pretty cool when you think about that. That landowner did not have to do that. And it's changed our life, you know? And so when you think of it that way, it's pretty darn cool. And so I would have to say that it's not a particular, I mean, there's many great hunts over the dog or a nice shot on a rooster, or, I mean, there's a lot of those, but I would say it's that one plots tract. And I won't tell you where it is, by the way, but, but it is, you know, everybody probably has one of those. I think that's just really special to them. And, that's what it would be for me.
Yeah. I went to that place in my mind as you were explaining it. Yeah. And you're right. It's the summation of all those singular events that makes it one of the most important places in your entire life. And you don't have to be, carrying a shotgun to go back and relive all those. Those are incredible.
It's gotten to be so common that my dog knows how to hunt it even without, you know, we just know the pattern, and then we know where we're going to go if we're going to corner a rooster or if we're going to hunt the wetland, or it's just a neat spot. And so it's nice. It's almost like a permanent fixture, like a WMA or something. It's become that close. So pretty cool
spot.
And
you think about how fragile that property could be if one person does something completely ignorant and then it's no longer accessible to anybody and it goes away, and all those, the next generation of memories don't even exist.
Yeah. Pretty fragile.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Great point. Emily, as you think about putting a bow on this episode of the podcast, what comes to mind for you?
Well, it's tough to follow up Kevin's answer there. And Bob, I know you've spent a fair bit of time in North Dakota on some plots land, so I would like to hear yours as well after I tell you mine. But a similar boat as Kevin, there's too many to pick from. I did pick one, and it was two seasons ago. It was Quill's first season back in the field. And almost a year to the day after he had his accident in the field where he got very seriously injured, Quill is Renee Tamala's wire hair, if you aren't familiar. Renee Tamala is our senior field rep for North Dakota and Northeast Montana. But I was with her when he got injured, and then almost a year later to the day, we got to take him out to go hunting, and I was able to shoot a rooster over him. So that was one of my favorite memories on a piece of plots ground, and I think it's always probably going to be up there at the top.
Yeah, it's hard, like Kevin said too, to boil it down to one. And when I think about North Dakota, I think about the collection of access opportunities. It plots is incredible. Then you add school trust lands, and you add WMA, or you guys refer to them as gate protection areas in
wildlife management areas.
So they are WMAs in North Dakota, waterfall production areas in North Dakota, and you know, it's amazing the amount of public access opportunities that exist. If I have to boil it down to a singular moment, I love going to North Dakota for something we talked about very little, and that's Sharpies. The every season begins anew for me in North Dakota. And so that means often my youngest pups' first experience with success in a wild bird situation happens in North Dakota, and often on plots land. So I think about, you know, my young Gitche dog having her first point flush retrieve on a North Dakota plots land, and I'll carry that with me forever. Those memories, the meal that came from it, and you know, that experience with that dog is priceless. You know, and it all relates back to a landowner being generous enough to open that experience to me. So hopefully, you know, we mentioned 830,000 acres of plots that are available in North Dakota. Hopefully there's a few of you landowners that are enrolled in plots listening, and hopefully you hear this heartfelt thank you from me, but then on behalf of the entire Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever audience. We're blue platers and green platers and, you know, orange platers from all over the country traveling to your state to experience the beauty and the abundant wildlife that you have to offer. And whether we say it to your face in person, knocking on your door, hopefully you hear it across the airwaves. Thank you. Thanks for enrolling in a program that's pretty darn special. Emily, Kevin, thank you very much for sharing your stories, sharing a little background on a really, really special program, the North Dakota Plots Program, private land open to sportsmen. I'm Bob St. Pierre, reminding you to always follow the dog, especially if you're in North Dakota going hunting on some plots property. Something good will rise. Thanks for listening, folks.